Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Search Incident to Arrest by Recalled Warrant Edition. Today our featured guest is University of Louisville Professor of Law Luke Milligan, discussing Herring v. United States, heard an oral argument on Tuesday, October 7th. Thanks for tuning in. In this case, the Supreme Court considers the limits of the exclusionary rule. The case arises from a search incident to the arrest of Benny Dean Herring by police officers in Coffee County, Alabama. An investigator, suspicious of Herring, checked to see if there was a warrant for his arrest in neighboring Dale County, and was informed that there was. So Herring was arrested, and the search incident to arrest turned up methamphetamine and a pistol. In the meantime, however, the Dale County warrant clerk discovered that the warrant for Herring's arrest had actually been recalled, but the arrest and search were already complete. Herring was charged and convicted with possession of methamphetamine and being a felon in possession of a firearm. He appealed, arguing that the district court had erred in refusing to grant his motion to suppress the evidence from the unconstitutional search, but the 11th Circuit affirmed. The Supreme Court is now asked to decide whether the Fourth Amendment requires the exclusion of evidence seized incident to an arrest conducted on the basis of credible, but ultimately erroneous information negligently provided by another law enforcement agent. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Milligan.
Hello. My name is Luke Milligan. I'm an assistant professor of law at the University of Louisville. I would like to offer a brief summary of what I see as the central issues in the case of Herring versus United States, which was recently argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. The case has generated a fair amount of attention in that it's the court's first opportunity to revisit the exclusionary rule since its 2006 decision in Hudson versus Michigan. In Hudson, the court ruled that the exclusionary rule did not apply to police violations of the knock-and-announce rule. The opinion was widely noted for its broad language, suggesting that the exclusionary rule has become, in many ways, anachronistic. So the Herring case, being the first post-Hudson exclusionary rule case, has drawn the attention of many. Will the court act in the spirit of Hudson and make another deep cut into the exclusionary rule, or will the court instead signal that it's looking to contain the impact of Hudson? The facts of the Herring case involve communications between police departments in two neighboring Alabama counties, Coffee County and Dale County. Benny Herring, the petitioner in this case, drove to the impoundment lot at the police station in Coffee County. He was looking to retrieve some personal possessions that he had left behind in an impounded vehicle. While Herring was at the impound lot, a Coffee County investigator became suspicious and asked a police clerk to check to see whether there were any outstanding warrants for Herring's arrest in any of the nearby counties. The Coffee County police clerk then contacted a police clerk from neighboring Dale County. The Dale County clerk checked the Dale County arrest warrant database. The database stated that there was indeed an outstanding warrant for Herring's arrest. The Dale County clerk then conveyed this information to the Coffee County clerk, who in turn relayed the information to the investigating officer in Coffee County. Herring was promptly arrested, and in the search incident to his arrest, officers seized methamphetamine from Herring's pocket and a pistol from underneath the seat of his truck. Yet just minutes after Herring's arrest, the Coffee County Police Department learned that the Dale County warrant database had not been properly updated and that the arrest warrant for Herring had, in fact, been recalled months earlier. Herring was nonetheless indicted on charges of possessing methamphetamine and being a felon in possession of a firearm. He, not surprisingly, moved to suppress the evidence of the drugs and firearm, arguing that he had been arrested illegally and thus the contraband should be excluded as the fruits of a Fourth Amendment violation. Now, because the government stipulated that Herring's arrest had indeed violated the Fourth Amendment, the sole issue before the district court was whether the exclusion of the drugs and gun was the proper remedy for this constitutional violation. The district court made a couple of important findings. First, the negligent maintenance of records was attributed to the Dale County police clerks. Second, the court concluded that suppression of the evidence would not sufficiently deter similar violations in the future. So based on these findings, the district court refused to suppress the evidence, and Herring was ultimately convicted. On appeal, the 11th Circuit affirmed. The panel explained that the evidence should not be suppressed because the arresting officer in Coffee County had acted in good faith when he relied on the database error from Dale County. The U.S. Supreme Court granted cert on this issue. For nearly a century now, the judicially created exclusionary rule has been a central remedy for Fourth Amendment violations. In any given case, the application of the exclusionary rule will turn on a cost-benefit analysis. The rule is only applicable when its deterrence value is thought to outweigh the societal cost of lost evidence and lost convictions. As the court often likes to say, the exclusionary rule has to pay its own way. Based on this cost-benefit analysis, the court has, over time, carved out a series of categorical exceptions to this default rule of exclusion. One such categorical exception is sometimes referred to as the good faith rule. This so-called good faith exception provides that when the Fourth Amendment is violated, suppression is not required when the violating officer relied in good faith on the negligent representation of another government official. The rationale here is that since the violating officer acted in good faith, suppression would have an insufficient deterrent effect. Now, this good faith exception has, as of today, a very narrow scope. It has been applied to only those cases where the negligent misrepresentation was made by a non-law enforcement official, such as a judge, a court clerk, or a legislator. And so the courts have operated on the premise that the good faith exception is never available when a police officer relies in good faith on the negligent representation of another police officer. And police officer, as a term, has always extended to include adjuncts, such as backroom staff employed by the police department. As counsel in Herring put it, this is a time-honored position. And the rationale of this time-honored position is as follows. Allowing one cop to insulate his Fourth Amendment violation by having another officer conduct the search would create obvious and perverse incentives for law enforcement. The court's 1995 decision in Arizona v. Evans sets the backdrop for the Herring case. There, the court held that the good faith rule applied where officers relied reasonably on a court clerk's negligent maintenance of a warrant database. Herring, of course, raises a different issue because the district court here found that the negligence was not by the clerk of court's office, but by the clerks at the police department. Because Herring involves negligence by a law enforcement employee, the good faith exception, as traditionally understood, does not salvage the evidence seized from Herring. Now, working within this Evans precedent, Herring argues that the Supreme Court should adopt a rule that any database error by the police should result in suppression. Herring, in effect, asks the court, when analyzing an officer's good faith reliance on a negligent error, to maintain the longstanding distinction between police errors and non-police errors. Now, the government, on the other hand, argues that the good faith rule's distinction between police errors and non-police errors needs to be relaxed under some circumstances. It argues that the good faith line should be drawn finer between regular police errors and police database errors. That is, officers should be able to reasonably rely on databases, no matter whose fault it is, police or court clerks. In other words, no matter who can be blamed for the error in the database, officers should be able to reasonably rely on the information in that database. The bulk of the briefing and oral argument in Herring has focused on these two proposed distinctions. Each side attacks the other's rule on deterrence and efficiency grounds. Herring, for one, claims that his distinction in the exclusionary rule context between police errors and non-police errors will significantly deter future database negligence. He argues, without exclusion, in this case, perverse incentives would arise with respect to police record keeping. There would be a push, he argues, to structure operations so as to leave officers in the field ignorant of deficiencies in record management. Herring argues in his brief that, quote, police might set up their databases to return indications that warrants exist not only for the individuals actually named in a warrant, but also for individuals with similar names in the hope that this would permit a broader range of searches to which exceptions to the exclusionary rule would apply, unquote. The United States sees the deterrence issue a different way. It argues that distinguishing all police errors from non-police errors, and thus suppressing evidence resulting from errors in police negligent maintenance of databases, will not have a sufficient deterrent impact. It argues that exclusion is not necessary to deter database violations because strong incentives to maintain these databases already exist. For example, the government explains that police will, without exclusion, still maintain databases responsibly because they don't want to waste resources arresting the wrong people. The police want to maintain institutional credibility with the community and nearby police departments. The police don't want to be subjected to civil suits. Now, Herring, of course, responds that qualified immunity makes civil suits impossible in these slices of cases. Lastly, the government argues that exclusion is not necessary to deter police because police already would face reprimand or other job discipline for carelessness in maintaining the databases. Their sort of last point is that these databases are generally run by clerks, and such sort of back office law enforcement employees are simply not engaged in the often competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime in the same way as frontline officers are. So the argument is suppressing evidence would not be as strong of a punishment for these back office employees. Now, the United States argues additionally that even if the court thinks that police database negligence can be deterred with exclusion, such deterrence is impossible in a situation like Herring's, where the negligence was by a police department, the Dale County Sheriff's Department, that was separate from that of the Department of the Arresting Officer, the Coffee County Sheriff's Department. The government points out that Coffee County has no control over record keeping in Dale County. They have no mechanism for identifying, disciplining, or providing further training to the particular Dale County employee who made the error. So those are the major claims relating to the deterrent impact of exclusion in this case. The government, in addition to attacking Herring's rule as being over-deterrent, challenges the workability of Herring's proposed rule. During oral argument, the justices indeed seem skeptical of Herring's claim that the distinction between police and non-police errors would be realistic in the context of database negligence. The Chief Justice and Justices Scalia and Alito were particularly concerned that because both law enforcement and court personnel necessarily have to collaborate on database maintenance, the district court's task of identifying a negligent actor would be nearly impossible or at the least impractical. Justices Scalia and Kennedy seemed additionally concerned that such negligent database claims, if not properly tailored, could devolve into full-blown hearings on, or perhaps even cumbersome audits of, the jurisdiction's warrant database. The justices' concern over the workability of Herring's rule, along with the court's general views on the exclusionary rule, as evidenced in Hudson, makes it seem unlikely that Herring will prevail in this case. The more interesting question, I think, is how broadly the court will write its opinion. There are many possible avenues the court could take. The most dramatic would be to extend the good faith exception to all negligent police errors. A less unsettling course would be to extend the good faith rule to all negligent police errors by departments other than those of the arresting officer. My guess, however, is that the court will take a more tailored approach. The argument and briefs were targeted to coming up with a good and workable rule narrowed to databases. It seems to me that the justices are likely to expand the holding in Evans from non-police database negligence to all database negligence. In sum, the practical impact of such a ruling is not entirely clear. After all, there is uncertainty regarding the accuracy of local warrant databases. That said, I believe the expansion of Evans from non-police negligence to police negligence would have substantial symbolic effect. It would constitute the first time the court has deviated from the time-honored position that officers cannot avoid exclusion by relying on the negligent representation of another law enforcement agent. Such a holding, albeit a narrow one, would constitute the beginning rather than the end, as it would certainly open the floodgates to previously untenable claims of good faith reliance on police negligence. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.